Microsoft, Scalpers Inc. would be informed, whereupon it would set off to buy 1,000 shares of Microsoft offered in the market, and without taking the risk of owning the stock for even an instant, sell it to you at a higher price. Scalpers Inc. is prohibited from taking the slightest market risk. When it buys, it has the seller firmly in hand. When it sells, it has the buyer in hand. And at the end of every trading day, it will have no position at all in the stock market. Scalpers Inc. trades for the sole purpose of interfering with trading that would have happened without it. In buying from every seller and selling to every buyer, it winds up A, doubling the trades in the marketplace, and B, being exactly 50% of that booming volume. It adds nothing to the market, but at the same time might be mistaken for the central player in that market. This state of affairs, as it happens, resembles the United States stock market after the passage of Reg NMS. From 2006 to 2008, high-frequency traders' share of total U.S. stock market trading doubled from 26% to 52%, and it has never fallen below 50% since then. The total number of trades made in the stock market also spiked dramatically from roughly 10 million per day in 2006 to just over 20 million per day in 2009. Liquidity was one of those words Wall Street people threw around when they wanted the conversation to end, and for brains to go dead, and for all questioning to cease. A lot of people used it as a synonym for activity or volume of trading, but it obviously needed to mean more than that, as activity could be manufactured in a market simply by adding more front runners to it. To get at a useful understanding of liquidity and the likely effects of high-frequency trading on it, one might better begin by studying the effect on investors' willingness to trade once they sense that they are being front-run by this new front-running entity. Brad himself had felt the effect. When the market, as displayed on his screens, became illusory, he became less willing to take risk in that market to provide liquidity. He could only assume that every other risk-taking intermediary, every other useful market participant, must have felt exactly the same way. The argument for HFT was that it provided liquidity. But what did this mean? HFT firms go home flat every night, said Brad. They don't take positions. They are bridging an amount of time between buyers and sellers that's so small that no one even knows it exists. After the market was computerized and decimalized in 2000, spreads in the market had narrowed. That much was true. Part of that narrowing would have happened anyway, with the automation of the stock market, which made it easier to trade stocks priced in decimals rather than in fractions. Part of that narrowing was an illusion. What appeared to be the spread was not actually the spread. The minute you went to buy or sell at the stated market price, the price moved. What Scalpers Inc. did was to hide an entirely new sort of activity behind the mask of an old mental model, in which the guy who makes markets is necessarily taking market risk and providing liquidity. But Scalpers Inc. took no market risk. In early 2013, one of the largest high-frequency traders, Virtu Financial, publicly boasted that in 5.5 years of trading, it had experienced just one day when it hadn't made money, and that the loss was caused by human error. In 2008, Dave Cummings, the CEO of a high-frequency trading firm called TradeBot, told university students that his firm had gone 4 years without a single day of trading losses. This sort of performance is possible only if you have a huge informational advantage. In spirit, Scalpers Inc. was less a market enabler than a weird sort of market burden. Financial intermediation is a tax on capital. It's the toll paid by both the people who have it and the people who put it to productive use. Reduce the tax, and the rest of the economy benefits. Technology should have led to a reduction in this tax. The ability of investors to find each other without the help of some human broker might have eliminated the tax altogether. Instead, this new beast rose up in the middle of the market, and the tax increased by billions of dollars. Or had it? To measure the cost to the economy of Scalpers, Inc., you needed to know how much money it made. That was not possible. The new intermediaries were too good at keeping their profits secret. A former employee of Citadel, who also once had top-secret security clearance at the Pentagon, says, "To get into the Pentagon and into my area, it took two badge swipes, one to get into the building and one to get into my area. Guess how many badge swipes it took me to get to my seat at Citadel? 5. Secrecy might have been the signature trait of the entities who now sat at the middle of the stock market. You had to guess what they were making from what they spent to make it. Investors who eyeballed the situation did not find reason for hope. There used to be this guy called Vinny who worked on the floor of the stock exchange, said one big investor who had observed the market for a long time. After the markets closed, Vinny would get into his Cadillac and drive out to his big house in Long Island. Now there is a guy called Vladimir who gets into his jet and flies to his estate in Aspen for the weekend. I used to worry a little about Vinny. Now I worry a lot about Vladimir. Apart from taking some large sum of money out of the market, and without taking risk or adding anything of use to that market, Scalpers Inc. had other, less intended consequences. Scalpers Inc. inserted itself into the middle of the stock market not just as an unnecessary middleman, but as a middleman with incentives to introduce dysfunction into the stock market. Scalpers Inc. was incentivized, for instance, to make the market as volatile as possible. The value of its ability to buy Microsoft from you at $30 a share and to hold the shares for a few microseconds, knowing that even if the Microsoft share price began to fall, it could turn around and sell the shares at $30.01, was determined by how likely it was that Microsoft share price, in those magical microseconds, would rise in price. The more volatile Microsoft share price, the higher Microsoft stock price might move during those microseconds, and the more Scalpers Inc. would be able to scalp. One might argue that intermediaries have always profited from market volatility, but that is not really true. The old specialists on the New York Stock Exchange, for instance, because they were somewhat obliged to buy in a falling market and to sell in a rising one, often found that their worst days were the most volatile days. They thrived in times of relative stability. Another incentive of Scalpers Inc. is to fragment the marketplace. The more sites at which the same stocks changed hands, the more opportunities to front-run investors from one site to another. The bosses at Scalpers Inc. would thus encourage new exchanges to open, and would also encourage them to place themselves at some distance from each other. Scalpers Inc. also had a very clear desire to maximize the difference between the speed of their private view of the market and the view afforded the wider public market. The more time that Scalpers Inc. could sit with some investor's stock market order, the greater the chance that the price might move in the interim. Thus, an earnest employee of Scalpers Inc. would look for ways either to slow down the public's information or to speed up his own. The final new incentive introduced by Scalpers Inc. was perhaps the most bizarre. The easiest way for Scalpers, Inc. to extract the information it needed to front-run other investors was to trade with them. At times, it was possible to extract the necessary information without having to commit to a trade. That's what the flash order scandal had been about. High-frequency traders being allowed by the exchanges to see other people's orders before anyone else, without any obligation to trade against them. But for the most part, if you wanted to find out what some big investor was about to do, you needed to do a little bit of it with him. For instance, to find out that, say, T. Rowe Price wanted to buy 5 million shares of Google Inc., you needed to sell some Google to T. Rowe Price. That initial market contact between any investor and Scalpers, Inc. was like the bait in a trap, a lost leader. For Scalpers, Inc., the goal was to spend as little as possible to acquire the necessary information, to make those initial trades, the bait, as small as possible. To an astonishing degree, since the implementation of Reg NMS, the U.S. financial markets had evolved to serve the narrow interests of Scalpers, Inc. Since the mid-2000s, the average trade size in the U.S. stock market had plummeted, the markets had fragmented, and the gap in time between the public view of the markets and the view of high-frequency traders had widened. The rise of high-frequency trading had been accompanied also by a rise in stock market volatility, over and above the turmoil caused by the 2008 financial crisis. The price volatility within each trading day in the U.S. stock market between 2010 and 2013 was nearly 40% higher than the volatility between 2004 and 2006, for instance. There were days in 2011 in which volatility was higher than in the most volatile days of the dot-com bubble. The financial crisis brought with it a great deal of stock market volatility. Perhaps people just assumed that there was supposed to be an unusual amount of drama in the stock market evermore. But then the financial crisis abated, and the drama remained. There was no good explanation for this, but Brad now had a glimmer of one. It had to do with the way a frontrunner operates. A frontrunner sells you 100 shares of some stock to discover that you are a buyer, and then turns around and buys everything else in sight, causing the stock to pop higher, or the opposite if you happen to be a seller. The Royal Bank of Canada had tested the effects on stock market volatility of using Thor, which stymied front runners rather than the standard order routers used by Wall Street, which did not. The sequential cost-effective router responded to the kickbacks and fees of the various exchanges and went to those exchanges first that paid them the most to do so. The spray router, which, as its name suggests, just sprayed the market and took whatever stock was available or tried to, did not make any effort to compel a stock market order to arrive at the different exchanges simultaneously. Every router, when it bought stock, tended to drive the price of that stock a bit higher. But when the stock had settled, say 10 seconds later, it settled differently with each router. The sequential cost-effective router caused the share price to remain higher than the spray router did, and the spray router caused it to move higher than Thor did. "I have no scientific evidence," said Brad. "This is purely a theory. But with Thor, the HFT firms are trying to cover their losses. I'm short when I don't want to be, so I need to buy to cover, quickly." The other two routers enabled HFT to front run, so they wound up being long the stock. With the other two, HFT is in a position to trade around a winning position, said Brad, and they can do whatever they can do to force the stock even higher, or lower if the investor who triggered the activity is a seller. They had, in those privileged microseconds, the reckless abandon of gamblers playing with house money. The new choppiness in the public U.S. stock markets was spreading to other financial markets as they, too, embraced high-frequency traders. It was what investors most noticed. They were less and less able to buy and sell big chunks of stock in a gulp. Their frustration with the public stock exchanges had led the big Wall Street banks to create private exchanges, dark pools. By the middle of 2011, roughly 30% of all stock market trades occurred off the public exchanges, most of them in dark pools. The appeal of these dark pools, said the Wall Street banks, was that investors could expose their big stock market orders without fear that those orders would be exploited. What bothered Rich Gates, at least at first, was the tone of the pitch he was hearing from the big Wall Street banks. All through 2008 and 2009, they would come to his office and tell him why he needed their algorithms to defend himself in the stock market. "This algo is like a tiger that lurks in the woods and waits for the prey and then jumps on it." Or, "This algo is like an anaconda in a tree." The algos had names like Ambush and Nighthawk and Raider and Dark Attack and Sumo. Citi had one called Dagger. Deutsche Bank had Slicer. And Credit Suisse had one named Gorilla, which came, in the bank's flip chart presentation, with a menacing drawing of Che Guevara wearing a beret and scowling. What the hell was that about? Their very names made Rich Gates wary. He also didn't like how loudly the brokers selling them told him they'd come to protect him. Protect him from what? Why did he need protection? From whom did he need to be protected? "I'm immediately skeptical of people saying they're looking out for my interests," Gates said, "especially on Wall Street." Gates ran a mutual fund, TFS Capital, that he had created in 1997 with friends from the University of Virginia. He liked to think of himself as a hick, but in truth, he was a keenly analytical math geek in the perfectly pleasant Philadelphia suburb of Westchester. He managed nearly $2 billion belonging to 35,000 small investors, but still positioned himself, even in his own mind, as an industry outsider. He believed that mutual funds were less often exercises in smart money management than in creepy marketing, and that many of the people who ran mutual funds should be doing something else with their lives. Back in 2007, to make this point, he dug out of a stack of league tables America's worst performing mutual fund, the Phoenix Market Neutral Fund. Over the prior decade, Gates's firm had earned its investors returns of 10% per year. Over that same period, the Phoenix Market Neutral Fund had lost 0.09% a year for its investors. The investors would have been better off hopping over the fence of the president of the Phoenix Market Neutral Fund's home and burying the money in his backyard. Gates wrote a letter to the Phoenix president saying, in effect, "You are so obviously inept at managing money that you could do your investors a favor by turning over all of your assets to me and letting me run them for you." The president failed to reply. The machismo of Wall Street's algorithms, combined with what struck Gates as a lot of nonsensical talk about the need for trading speed, stirred his naturally suspicious mind. "I just noticed a lot of bullshit," he said. He and his colleagues devised a test to see if there was anything in this new stock market to fear. The test, specifically, would show him if when he entered an order onto one of Wall Street's dark pools, he wound up getting ripped off by some unseen predator. He started by identifying stocks that didn't trade very often. Chipotle Mexican Grill, for instance. He sent in an order to a single Wall Street dark pool to buy that stock at the mid-market price. Say, for example, that the shares of Chipotle Mexican Grill were trading at 100 to 110. Gates would submit his bid to buy 1,000 shares of Chipotle at $100.05. There it would normally just sit until some other investor came along and lowered his price from $100.10 to $100.05. Gates didn't wait for that to happen. Instead, a few seconds later, he sent a second order to one of the public exchanges to sell Chipotle at $100.01. What should have happened next was that his order in the dark pool should have been filled at $100.01, the official new best price in the market. He should have been able to buy from himself the shares he was selling at $100.01. But that's not what happened. Instead, before he could blink his eye, he had made two trades. He had bought Chipotle from someone inside the Wall Street dark pool at $100.05 and sold it to someone else on the public exchange for $100.01. He'd lost 4 cents by, in effect, trading with himself. Only he hadn't traded with himself. Some third party had obviously used the sell order he had sent to the public exchange to exploit the buy order he had sent to the dark pool. Gates and his colleagues wound up making hundreds of such tests with their own money in several Wall Street dark pools. In the first half of 2010, there was only one Wall Street firm in whose dark pool the test came back positive, Goldman Sachs. In the Goldman dark pool, Sigma X, he got ripped off a bit more than half the time he ran the test. As Gates traded in lightly traded stocks, and high-frequency trading firms were overwhelmingly interested in heavily traded ones, these tests would have been vastly more likely to generate false negatives than false positives. Still, he was a bit surprised that Goldman, and only Goldman, seemed to be running a pool that allowed someone else to front-run his orders to the public stock exchanges. He called his broker at Goldman. He said it wasn't fair, said Gates, because it wasn't just them. He said it's happening all over. It's not just us. Gates was dutifully shocked. When I first saw the results of these tests, I thought, this obviously is not right. As far as he could tell, no one seemed much to care that 35,000 small investors could be so exposed to predation inside Wall Street's most prominent bank. I'm amazed that people don't ask the questions, he said, that they don't dig deeper. If some schmuck in Westchester, PA can figure it out, I've got to believe other people did too. Outraged, Gates called a reporter he knew at the Wall Street Journal. The reporter came to see Gates's tests and seemed interested, but 2 months later there was still no piece in the journal, and Gates sensed that there might never be. Among other things, the reporter was uncomfortable mentioning Goldman Sachs by name. At which point, Gates noticed that the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Customer Protection Act, soon to be passed, contained a whistleblower provision. I'm like, holy crap, I'm trying to out this anyway. If I can get paid, too, great. The people who worked in the SEC's Division of Trading and Markets were actually great, nothing like what the public imagined. They were smart and asked good questions and even spotted small mistakes in Gates's presentation, which he appreciated. Though, as with Brad Katsuyama, they gave him no idea how they might respond to the information he had given them. They wondered, shrewdly, exactly who was ripping off investors in Goldman's dark pool. They wanted to know if Goldman Sachs Prop Group was on the other side of the trade, said Gates. He had no answer for that. They don't tell you who took the other side of the trade, he said. All he knew was that he'd been ripped off in exactly the way you might expect to be ripped off when you can't see the market trading in real time and others can. And that, at least for a few months, was that. After I blew the whistle, I laid low, Gates said. I just wanted to focus on our business. I don't get off throwing bombs. Then came the flash crash, and the Wall Street Journal's interest was rekindled. The paper published a piece on Rich Gates' tests, without mentioning Goldman Sachs by name. I think it's going to set the world on fire, said Gates. It didn't do anything. There are 15 comments at the bottom of the piece on the web, and all of them are Russian mail-order brides. But the piece led a person close to both the Bats Exchange and Credit Suisse to get in touch with Gates with a suggestion. Run your tests again, specifically on the Bats Exchange and the Credit Suisse dark pool called Crossfinder. Just to see. Toward the end of 2010, Gates ran another round of tests. Sure enough, he was able to get himself ripped off in exactly the same way he had been ripped off in the Goldman Sachs dark pool, on the Bats Exchange and inside the Credit Suisse dark pool, and in some other places too. At Goldman Sachs, however, the tests were now negative. When we did it the first time, he said, it worked at Goldman, but nowhere else. When we did it 6 months later, it didn't work at Goldman, but it worked everywhere else. In May 2011, the small team Brad had created, Schwal, Ronan, Rob Park, a couple of others, sat around a table in Brad's office, surrounded by the applications of past winners of the Wall Street Journal's Technology Innovation Awards. As it turned out, RBC's marketing department had informed them of the awards the day before submissions were due, so they were scrambling to figure out in which of several categories they belonged and how to make Thor sound life-changing. There were papers everywhere, said Rob. No one sounded like us. There were people who had, like, cured cancer. It was stupid, said Brad. There wasn't even a category to put us into. I think we ended up applying under Other. With the purposelessness of the exercise hanging in the air, Rob said, I just had a sick idea. Rob's idea was to license the technology to one of the exchanges. Schwal had patented Thor for RBC. The line between Wall Street brokers and exchanges had blurred. The big Wall Street banks now ran their own private exchanges. The stock exchanges, for their part, were making a bid to become brokers. The bigger ones now offered a service that enabled brokers to simply hand them their stock market orders, which they would then route. To their own exchange, of course, but also to others. The service was used mainly by small regional brokerage firms that didn't have their own routers. But this brokerage-like service opened up, at least in Rob's mind, a new possibility. If just one of the exchanges was handed the tool for protecting investors from market predators, the small brokers from around the country might flock to it, and it might become the mother of all exchanges. Screw that, said Brad. Let's just create our own stock exchange. We just sat there for a while, said Rob, kind of staring at each other. Create your own stock exchange? What does that even mean? A few weeks later, Brad flew to Canada and sold his bosses on the idea of an RBC-led stock exchange. Then, in the fall of 2011, he canvassed a handful of the world's biggest money managers, Janus Capital, T. Rowe Price, BlackRock, Wellington, Southeastern Asset Management, and some of its most influential hedge fund managers, David Einhorn, Bill Ackman, Daniel Loeb. They all had the same reaction. They loved the idea of a stock exchange that protected investors from Wall Street's predators. They also thought that a new stock exchange, to be credibly independent of Wall Street, could not be created by a Wall Street bank. Not even a bank as nice as RBC. If Brad wanted to create the mother of all stock exchanges, he would need to quit his job and do it on his own. The challenges were obvious. He'd need to find money, He'd need to persuade a lot of highly paid people to quit their Wall Street jobs to work for tiny fractions of their current salaries, and possibly even supply the capital to pay themselves to work. I was asking, can I get the people I need? How long can we survive without getting paid? Will our significant others let us do this? He also needed to find out if the 9 big Wall Street banks that controlled nearly 70% of all stock market orders would be willing to send those orders to a truly safe exchange. It would be far more difficult to start an exchange premised on fairness if the banks that controlled the vast majority of the customers' orders were committed to unfairness. For a surprisingly long time, Brad had reserved final judgment about the biggest Wall Street banks. I held out a degree of hope that the people at each bank who handled the clients' orders were removed from the prop group, he said. His hope sprang mainly from his own experience. At RBC, where he handled the clients' orders, he barely knew the prop traders and had no idea what they were doing. There was reason for this. RBC had not created a dark pool because Brad had killed the idea. Still, he knew that each of the big Wall Street banks had its own internal politics, and that there were people in each of them who wanted to act in the long-term interests of their firms and do the right thing by their customers. His hope was that some of these people, in some of these places, had power. John Schwall's private investigations put an end to that hope. By the fall of 2011, Schwall had become something like a connoisseur of the uses of LinkedIn to find stuff out about people in and around high-frequency trading. He had put a face on high-frequency trading, or rather, two faces. I began to anticipate that certain people were in on the game, said Schwall. I'd connect to them so I could see their network. There were maybe 25 guys I called kingpins, the people who actually knew what was going on. At the very top of the food chain were a lot of white guys in their 40s whose careers could be traced back, one way or another, to the early electronic stock exchanges born of the regulations passed after the crash of 1987. Wall Street guys who might have some technical background, but whose identity was more trader than programming geek. The new players in the financial markets, the kingpins of the future who had the capacity to reshape those markets, were a different breed. The Chinese guy who had spent the previous 10 years in American universities. The French particle physicist from Fermat Lab. The Russian aerospace engineer. The Indian PhD in electrical engineering. There were just thousands of these people, said Schwall. Basically all of them with advanced degrees. I remember thinking to myself how unfortunate it was that so many engineers were joining these firms to exploit investors rather than solving public problems. These highly trained scientists and technicians tended to be pulled onto Wall Street by the big banks, and then, after they had learned the ropes, to move on to smaller, high-frequency trading shops. They behaved more like free agents than employees of a big corporation. In their LinkedIn profiles, for instance, they revealed all sorts of information that their employers almost certainly would not want revealed. Here Schwall stumbled upon the predator's weakness. The employees of the big Wall Street banks felt no more loyalty toward the banks than the banks felt toward them. The employees of Credit Suisse offered the clearest example. Credit Suisse's dark pool, Crossfinder, vied with Goldman Sachs' Sigma X to be Wall Street's biggest private stock exchange. Credit Suisse's biggest selling point to investors was that it put their interests first and protected them from whatever it was that high-frequency traders were doing. Back in October 2009, the head of Advanced Execution Services, AES, at Credit Suisse, Dan Matheson, had testified before a U.S. Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee at a hearing on dark pools. The argument that dark pools are somehow part of the high-frequency trading debate simply does not make sense, he'd said. High-frequency traders make their money by digesting publicly available information faster than others. Dark pools hide order information from everyone. That, Schwal thought, because Brad had explained it all to him, was simply wrong. It was true that when, say, a pension fund gave a Wall Street bank an order to buy 100,000 shares of Microsoft, and the Wall Street bank routed the order to the dark pool, the wider world was not informed. But that was just the beginning of the story. The pension fund did not know the rules of the dark pool and could not see how the buy order was handled inside of it. The pension fund would not be able to say, for example, whether the Wall Street Bank allowed its own proprietary traders to know of the big buy order, or if those traders had used their, faster than the dark pool, market connections to front-run the order on the public exchanges. Even if the Wall Street Bank resisted the temptation to trade for itself against its own customers, there was virtually no chance they resisted the temptation to sell access to the dark pool to high-frequency traders. The Wall Street banks did not disclose which high-speed trading firms had paid them for special access to their dark pools, or how much they had paid, but selling that access was standard practice. Raising again the obvious question, why would anyone pay for access to the customer's orders inside a Wall Street bank's dark pool? The straight answer was that a customer's stock market order, inside a dark pool, was fat and juicy prey. The order was typically large, and its movements were especially predictable. Each Wall Street bank had its own detectable pattern for handling orders. The order was also slow because of the time it was forced to spend inside the dark pool before accessing the wider market. As Brad had put it, you could front-run an order in a dark pool on a bicycle. The pension fund trying to buy 100,000 shares of Microsoft could, of course, specify that the Wall Street Bank not take its orders to the public exchanges at all, but simply rest it, hidden, inside the dark pool. But an order hidden inside a dark pool wasn't very well hidden. Any decent high-frequency trader who had paid for a special connection to the pool would ping the pool with tiny buy and sell orders in every listed stock, searching for activity. Once they had discovered the buyer of Microsoft, they'd simply wait for the moment when Microsoft ticked lower on the public exchanges and sell it to the pension fund in the dark pool at the stale, higher, best price, as Rich Gates' tests had demonstrated. It was riskless, larcenous, and legal, made so by Reg NMS. The way Brad had described it, it was as if only one gambler were permitted to know the scores of last week's NFL games, with no one else aware of his knowledge. He places bets in the casino on every game and waits for other gamblers to take the other side of those bets. There's no guarantee that anyone will do so, but if they do, he's certain to win. In his investigation of the people who manage Credit Suisse's dark pool, one of the first things Schwal noticed was the guy in charge of electronic trading, Josh Stampfli, who had joined Credit Suisse after 7 years spent working for Bernie Madoff. Stampfli has not been charged with any wrongdoing. Madoff had pioneered the idea of paying brokers for the right to execute the broker's customers' orders, which should have told people something, but apparently did not. This, of course, only heightened Schwal's suspicions and sent him digging around in old articles in trade journals about Credit Suisse's dark pool. There he found references and allusions that made sense only if Credit Suisse had planned, right from the start, to be deeply involved with high-frequency trading firms. For instance, in April 2008, a guy named Dmitry Galanov, a director and the head of liquidity strategy at Credit Suisse, had told the Securities Technology Monitor that many of Credit Suisse's clients had placed computer servers in Weehawken, New Jersey, to be closer to Credit Suisse's dark pool. The only people who put servers next to dark pools in Weehawken were Ronan's old clients, the high-frequency trading firms. No stock market investor went to such lengths to shave microseconds off trading time. Client, to Credit Suisse, appeared to Schwall to be a category that included high-frequency trading firms. Schwall's suspicion that Credit Suisse wanted to service HFT while not seeming to do so grew after he read an interview Dan Matheson gave to the New York Times in November 2009. Question: Who are your clients at Crossfinder, and how do they benefit from using a dark pool as opposed to just going through a broker and trading on the exchange? Answer: Our clients are mutual funds, pension funds, hedge funds, and some other large broker dealers, so it is always institutional clients. All the large high-frequency trading firms, Schwall knew, were broker dealers. They had to be to gain the special access they had to the public stock exchanges, so Matheson had not ruled out dealing with them. The only reason he would not explicitly rule out dealing with them, Schwall assumed, was that he was dealing with them. The LinkedIn searches became a new obsession. The former Madoff employee's profile led him to the people who worked for the former Madoff employee, who led him to the people who worked for them, and so on. Even as Credit Suisse tried to appear as if it had nothing to do with high-frequency trading, its employees begged to differ. Schwall dug out dozens of examples of Credit Suisse's computer programmers boasting on their resumes about building high-frequency trading platforms and implementing high-frequency trading strategy, or of experience as a quantitative trader on equity and equity derivatives, high-frequency trading. One guy explained that he had managed onboarding of all high-frequency clients to Crossfinder. Another said he had built the Credit Suisse Crossfinder dark pool and now worked in high-frequency trading market making. Credit Suisse claimed that its dark pool had nothing to do with high-frequency trading, and yet it somehow employed in and around its dark pool a motherload of high-frequency trading talent. By the time he'd finished, Schwall had built the entire Credit Suisse dark pool organization chart. "He's got these people charts," said Brad incredulously. "It's like one of those FBI boards with the drug kingpins." Looking over Schwall's charts on Credit Suisse, the bank that went to the most trouble to sell itself as safe to investors, Brad decided that the game was probably over inside all the big Wall Street banks. All of them, one way or another, were probably using the unequal speeds in the market to claim their share of the prey. He further assumed that the big Wall Street banks must have stumbled upon his solution to high-frequency front-running and must have chosen not to use it because they had too great a stake in the profits generated by that front-running. It became very obvious to me why we were the first to discover Thor, because we weren't, he said. What that meant to me was that the problem was going to be much, much harder to solve. It also told me why the clients were so in the dark, because the clients rely on brokers for information. Creating an exchange designed to protect the prey from the predator would mean starting a war on Wall Street between the banks and the investors they claim to represent. Schwall's private investigations also revealed to Brad just how little the technical people understood of their role in the financial world. "It's not like you are building a bridge connecting two pieces of land," he said. "You can't see the effects of what you are doing." The openness with which the Credit Suisse technologists described their activities made him aware of a larger, almost charming obliviousness. "I was totally shocked when John started to pull out these resumes," he recalled. The banks had adopted a policy of saying as little as possible about what they were actually doing. They'd fire people for being quoted in the newspaper. But in their LinkedIn pages, those same people said whatever they wanted. From the way the engineers described their roles in the new financial system, he could see that they had no clue about the injustices of that system. "It told me that these tech guys were completely oblivious to what they were working on," he said. "They were tying these things they were working on, helping the bank to make markets in their dark pools, building automated systems for the bank to use with its customers, in a way you never would if you understood what the banks were doing. It's like saying on your LinkedIn profile, 'I have all the skills of a robber, and I know this one house intimately.'" Schwal had started out looking for the villains who were committing crimes against the life savings of ordinary Americans, fully aware of their own villainy. He wound up finding mainly a bunch of people who had no idea of the meaning of their own lives. In his searches, Schwal noticed something else, though at first he didn't know what to make of it. A surprisingly large number of the people pulled in by the big Wall Street banks to build the technology for high-frequency trading were Russians. If you went to LinkedIn and looked at one of these Russian guys, you would see he was linked to all the other Russians, said Schwal. "I'd go to find Dmitry, and I'd also find Misha, and Vladimir, and Tolstoy, or whatever." The Russians came not from finance, but from telecom, physics, medical research, university math departments, and a lot of other useful fields. The big Wall Street firms had become machines for turning analytically minded Russians into high-frequency traders. Schwal filed that fact away for later as something perhaps worth thinking about. Chapter 5. Putting a Face on HFT. Sergei Alenikov wasn't the world's most eager immigrant to America, or for that matter, to Wall Street. He had left Russia in 1990, the year after the fall of the Berlin Wall, but more in sadness than in hope. "When I was 19, I haven't imagined leaving it," he says. "I was very patriotic about Russia. I cried when Brezhnev died, and I always hated English. I thought I was completely incapable of learning languages." His problem with Russia was that its government wouldn't allow him to study what he wanted to study. He wasn't religious in any conventional sense, but he had been born a Jew, which had been noted on his Russian passport to remind everyone of the fact. As a Jew, he expected to be given especially difficult entrance exams to university, which, if he passed them, would grant him access to just one of two Moscow universities that were more accepting of Jews, where he would study whatever the authorities permitted Jews to study. Math, in Serge's case. He'd been willing to tolerate this state of affairs. However, as it happened, he had also been born to program computers. He hadn't laid hands on a computer until 1986, when he was already 16. The first thing he'd done was to write a program. He instructed the computer to draw a picture of a sine wave. When the computer actually followed his instructions, he was hooked. What hooked him, he said, was its detailed orientation, the way it requires an ability to see the problem and tackle it from different angles. It's not just like chess, but like solving a particular problem in chess. The more challenging problem is not to play chess, but to write the code that will play chess. He found that coding engaged him, not just intellectually, but also emotionally. "Writing a program is like giving birth to a child," he said. "It is a creation. Even though it is technical, it is a work of art. You get this level of satisfaction." He applied to switch his major from mathematics to computer science, but the authorities forbade it. "That is what tipped me to accept the idea that perhaps Russia is not the best place for me, he says, when they wouldn't allow me to study computer science. He arrived in New York City in 1990 and moved into a dorm room at the 92nd Street Young Men's and Young Women's Hebrew Association, a sort of Jewish YMCA. Two things shocked him about his new home: the diversity of the people on the streets and the fantastic range of foods in the grocery stores. He took photographs of the rows and rows of sausages in Manhattan and mailed them to his mother in Moscow. I'd never seen so many sausages, he says. But once he had marveled at the American cornucopia, he stepped back from it all and wondered just how necessary all of this food was. He read books about fasting and the effects of various highly restrictive diets. I decided to look at it a little bit further and ask what is beneficial and what is not, he said. In the end, he became a finicky vegetarian. I don't think all the energy you gain comes from food, he says. I think it comes from your environment. He'd come to America with no money at all and no real idea how to get it. He took a course on how to apply for a job. It was quite frightening, he says. I didn't speak English, really, and a resume was a totally alien concept. His first interviewer asked Serge to tell him about himself. To a Russian mentality, said Serge, that question means, where are you born? Who are your siblings? Serge described for the man at great length how he had come from a long line of Jewish scholars and academics and nothing else. He tells me I will hear from him again. I never do. But he had an obvious talent for programming computers and soon found a job doing it for $8.75 an hour in a New Jersey medical center. From the medical center, he landed a better job in the Rutgers University Computer Science Department, where, through some complicated combination of jobs and grants, he was able to pursue a master's degree. After Rutgers, he spent a few years working at internet startups until, in 1998, he received a job offer from a big New Jersey telecom company called IDT. For the next decade, he designed computer systems and wrote the code to route millions of phone calls each day to the cheapest available phone lines. When he joined the company, it had 500 employees. By 2006, it had 5,000, and he was its star technologist. That year, a headhunter called him and told him that there was fierce new demand on Wall Street for his particular skill, writing code that parsed huge amounts of information at great speed. Serge knew nothing about Wall Street and was in no particular rush to learn about it. His singular talent was for making computers go fast, but his own movements were slow and deliberate. The headhunter pressed upon him a bunch of books about writing software on Wall Street, plus a primer on how to make it through a Wall Street job interview, and told him that on Wall Street, he could make a lot more than the $220,000 a year he was making at the telecom company. Serge felt flattered and liked the headhunter, but he read the books and decided Wall Street wasn't for him. He enjoyed the technical challenges at the giant telecom and didn't really feel the need to earn more money. A year later, in early 2007, the headhunter called him again. By this time, IDT was in serious financial trouble. Serge was beginning to worry that the management was running the company into the ground. He had no savings to speak of. His wife, Alina, was carrying their third child, and they'd need to buy a bigger house. Serge agreed to interview with the Wall Street firm that especially wanted to meet him, Goldman Sachs. At least on the surface, Serge Alenikov had the sort of life people are said to come to America for. He'd married a pretty fellow Russian immigrant and started a family with her. They'd sold their two-bedroom Cape-style house in Clifton, New Jersey, and bought a bigger colonial-style one in Little Falls. They had a nanny. They had a circle of Russians they called their friends. On the other hand, all Serge did was work, and his wife had no real clue what that work involved. They weren't actually all that close to each other. He didn't encourage people to get to know him well or exhibit a great deal of interest in getting to know them. He was acquiring a lot of possessions in which he had very little interest. The lawn in Clifton was a fair example of the general problem. When he'd gone hunting for his first house, he'd been enchanted by the idea of having his very own lawn. In Moscow, such a thing was unheard of. The moment he owned a lawn, he regretted it. A pain in the butt to mow. A Russian writer named Masha Lader, who knew the Alenikovs as well as anyone, thought of Serge as an exceptionally intellectually gifted but otherwise typical Russian-Jewish computer programmer for whom technical problems became an excuse not to engage with the messy world around him. All of Serge's life was some kind of mirage, she said, or a dream. He was not aware of things. He liked slender girls who loved to dance. He married a girl and managed to have three kids with her before he figures out he doesn't really know her. He was working his ass off, and she would spend the money he was making. He would come home, and she would cook him vegetarian dishes. He was serviced, basically. And then Wall Street called. Goldman Sachs put Serge through a series of telephone interviews, then brought him in for a long day of face-to-face interviews. These he found extremely tense, even a bit weird. "I was not used to seeing people put so much energy into evaluating other people," he said. One after another, a dozen Goldman employees tried to stump him with brain teasers, computer puzzles, math problems, and even some light physics. It must have become clear to Goldman, it was to Serge, that he knew more about most of the things he was being asked than his interviewers did. At the end of the first day, Goldman invited him back for a second day. He went home and thought it over. He wasn't all that sure he wanted to work at Goldman Sachs. "But the next morning, I had a competitive feeling," he says. "I should conclude it and try to pass it because it's a big challenge." He'd been surprised to find that in at least one way he fit in. More than half the programmers at Goldman were Russians. Russians had a reputation for being the best programmers on Wall Street, and Serge thought he knew why. They had been forced to learn to program computers without the luxury of endless computer time. Many years later, when he had plenty of computer time, Serge still wrote out new programs on paper before typing them into the machine. "In Russia, time on the computer was measured in minutes," he said. "When you write a program, you are given a tiny time slot to make it work. Consequently, we learn to write the code in ways that minimize the amount of debugging. And so you had to think about it a lot before you committed it to paper. The ready availability of computer time creates this mode of working where you just have an idea and type it, and maybe erase it 10 times. Good Russian programmers, they tend to have had that one experience at some time in the past, the experience of limited access to computer time." He returned for another round of Goldman's grilling, which ended in the office of a senior high-frequency trader, another Russian, Alexander Davidovich. The Goldman managing director had just two final questions for Serge, both designed to test his ability to solve problems. The first, is 3,599 a prime number? Serge quickly saw that there was something strange about 3,599. It was very close to 3,600. He jotted down the following equations. 3,599 equals 3,600 minus 1 equals 60 squared minus 1 squared equals 60 minus 1 times 60 plus 1 equals 59 times 61. 3,599 equals 59 times 61. Not a prime number.